I am Dr. Jamie Kunkel. I'm joined here by Dr. Brian Plant. We're going to be talking about the gut today. But first, I'd like to introduce Dr. Plant a little bit, who's a colleague and friend of mine. I've actually worked with him extensively at our shared prior practice in the Sacramento area. Dr. Brian Plant is a licensed naturopathic doctor. He has extensive training in integrative healthcare approaches. He specializes in working with patients suffering from complex immune dysfunction, such as Lyme disease, chronic infections, viral infections, and environmental toxicities, including mold and metals, autoimmune disorders, mast cell activation, chronic fatigue. He helps patients recover from functional gastrointestinal conditions, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Adrenal and thyroid disorders, neuropsychiatric disorders as well. He conducts a comprehensive evaluation in order to get a complete picture and creates individualized treatment plans to address the patient's specific concerns. He's a graduate of National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, great school, and he's an active member of ILADS, fellow ILADS member, which is really cool as well. We'll just dive right in though here. I think we'll talk more about Plant as we go. We'll get a good sense of who he is. He's a really very smart, very sharp individual here with chronic diseases. He has the mind for it for sure. As we know, this can be difficult. So we're going to talk about mold, and we're going to talk about the gut, the central, you know, place of our woes sometimes, not always. It's nice when somebody comes in without a gut issue, but it comes up. Well, let's just say that. So please, let's just dive right in here, Dr. Plant, if you're cool with it. Explain the mechanisms of toxin removal from the body. Tell me about this concept of emunctories too. Like how do people get these toxins out of their body? And then we'll get into the gut specifically.
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. Dr. Kunkel has been an exceptional part of my training and work in with these conditions, and so I just want to acknowledge that. The gut is such a central place as it pertains to chronic immune dysfunction. So much of our immune activity happens at the gut barrier in particular, and when it comes to lack of digestion of foods, that can aggravate the inflammation at the gut barrier. And when it comes to improper ability to remove things from the gut, aka constipation or dysmotility, we can have a buildup of toxins. And so I'll go into that and talk about the emunctories, but just to kind of center our attention on the gut as like the primary arena where a lot of this stuff is taking place. And so the emunctories, I loved this concept when I was in naturopathic medical school because there didn't seem to be as much emphasis on it in conventional medicine, and it seems so central to the idea of how do we promote optimal health. And the emunctories are the organs of elimination. And a lot of times these organs also have other functions that we tend to focus more of our attention on. And we forget that they're actually really important in helping our body get rid of waste material, whether that's cellular / metabolic waste from our cells just doing their normal functions, or whether that's actually toxin removal of what we would call xenobiotics, or substances that are foreign to the body. A lot of these are synthetic, but also biological toxins such as microbial wastes and mycotoxins. And so the emunctories, what are they? There's the urinary system. So that's going to be the kidneys filtering the blood, and that things come out through the urine. That's the skin, which we often think about the skin as regulating temperature and moisture and protection and all that, but we don't often think about the skin as an organ of elimination. We actually sweat out a lot of toxins, mycotoxins, synthetic, organic toxins, and even heavy metals can be removed through the skin. The lungs, interestingly enough, we exhale carbon dioxide primarily as a waste, but other substances as well. This is kind of an aside, but garlic, the reason garlic breath is so difficult to get rid of is because it's not just in your mouth. It's actually, we're breaking down those sulfur containing molecules in the lungs and exhaling those. And so unless you were to, you know, nebulize or something, it's kind of hard to get rid of that. Anyway, but then our feature system for today is the liver, the gallbladder, and the large intestine, or really that whole integrative system, aka the digestive system. but primarily the liver and biliary system. So what that looks like is the blood is filtered, toxins are removed, they go through phase one and phase two metabolism in the liver. That basically is a process that allows the liver to, that allows these difficult to dissolve or remove toxins to be more soluble and are able to be actually eliminated through the body. And so that gets concentrated into bile, which is a kind of fat soluble emulsifier. That gets dumped through the gallbladder into the small intestine, and then that goes through the GI tract. Now, here's where things get really interesting. If I may keep going, I'm kind of
go for it.
Talking a lot, but the where things get interesting is our bodies evolved the ability to reabsorb bile. And this is called enterohepatic recirculation. And this is a really important concept because it speaks to kind of why we need binders and why we need to kind of make sure things go out of the body instead of recirculating. And so this was an incredibly adaptive mechanism, that recirculation and conservation of bile, when we weren't getting that much fat in our diets. So when our ancestors were running around foraging, you know, doing what they were doing, and maybe ate animal products, on like a feast or famine type basis, you needed to conserve bile because bile salts allow us to digest fat and, you know, do a lot of other things. The problem now is we don't have that issue, and yet our bodies still will conserve bile and recirculate things. So any fat soluble toxins, which is most of what we're talking about today, that are dissolved in the bile, if those don't get eliminated from the body, they're going to recirculate. So not only is the bile, but everything dissolved in the bile is recirculated. And so that's why we think about things like binders. Binders are going to bind to the bile salts. They're going to keep it in the intestinal tract. So then when you ideally have your bowel movement the next day or later that day, stuff comes out.
Right. Ideally, having a bowel movement and binding. That sounds a little hard if somebody's having trouble having bowel movements. Let's maybe touch base on the elephant in the room here. When the system isn't working very well, constipation or, you know, slow motility or, you know, the bile system's not working, the gallbladder, all that kind of stuff. So, but we can highlight the constipation piece. So is that something you're evaluating when you're seeing these folks for the first time?
Absolutely. So that's one of the first questions I ask is, how often are you having bowel movements? In naturopathic school, we learned this wonderful thing called the Bristol stool chart. If you're not familiar, it's a way of quantifying the consistency of stool from very hard and difficult to pass to liquid, basically 100% liquid on a scale of 1 to 7, respectively. We want type four, which is right in the middle, well-formed, not difficult to pass, not too loose, you know, but so often we're seeing chronic environmental toxin folks, including those with mycotoxic illness, not able to have daily bowel movements. And this is one of the things that kind of pricks my ears to the possibility, if they don't have an obvious history of mold exposure, that makes me think, okay, if there's some constipation going on in there, especially if it's severe, like I'm having bowel movements once a week, or I'm having bowel movements like every couple weeks. I've actually heard that a couple of times. More commonly, it's like every 2 to 3 days. But even that is going to affect our body's ability to remove metabolic waste and anything if we're incorporating binders. So if folks are constipated when they come in, giving them binders often makes things worse unless they're fiber-based binders. I learned about these tricks from Dr. Kunkel, so we'll talk about those for sure today. But like, what kind of binders would you use in somebody constipated? That's its own topic. But what are we doing in terms of they're not having regular bowel movements? Would you start them on a clay-based or charcoal-based or something like cholestyramine type binder right away? And my experience is definitely not, because then that stops things up. There's a doctor who does a lot of educational training who says, when you're doing a detox protocol, constipation isn't allowed. And I always appreciated that.
Yeah.
And so what I will often do is make sure that we're opening up those emunctories by giving things like digestive bitters. You know, I can talk a little bit about how those work. Magnesium citrate, sometimes ginger or 5-HTP. Basically, all these things that are going to help jumpstart the nervous system, and the blood flow to the GI tract and then soften stool with something like magnesium citrate and keep things moving so stuff can get out before we start binding.
Yeah, no, I like that. Well, yeah, so yeah, explain to the viewers here, how do bitters work exactly? Or how do some of these kinetic or, you know, motility agents work, you know, here for the gut, and why, and how are they also, if at all, friendly to the process of detoxification?
Yeah, so bitters are truly exceptional in what they do, and how they work is very interesting. So we have these taste receptors in our mouth that we would think about: salty, sweet, you know, bitter, you know, sour, those kinds of things. But interestingly enough, the bitter taste receptors are not just in our mouth; they're actually all the way through the GI tract, which makes it interesting. It's like, well, should we be even calling them taste receptors, or are they doing something else? And they are doing a lot of things. And so what they do is when we taste bitter, and it starts in the mouth and then goes through, it stimulates every stage of the digestive process. So increased saliva production, increased stomach acid production, stomach enzyme production, pancreatic enzyme production, bile production, and then motility, which is movement of the intestinal tract, also known as peristalsis. It's kind of like if you were to think about squeezing a tube of toothpaste from one end across the other, you have these smooth muscle contractions that are going throughout the GI tract, and that's moving food and ultimately moving stool. And so what bitter tastes do is they bind to those receptors and they stimulate all those processes. And so you can imagine in our standard American diet, without very many bitter foods, this process can become impaired. That's why a lot of folks like coffee. Coffee is probably the primary bitter food in an American diet. If you're not eating a lot of vegetables, part of why we start our meals with salads is actually to do that. Salad greens are bitter and they stimulate that. And so that's kind of how bitters work. Bitters are my personal favorite for patients struggling with constipation. I've seen folks that are on opiates for pain or post-surgical recovery. And they're using stool softeners, they're using magnesium, they're using laxatives, ginger sometimes, everything. But it's the bitters that I see being the most impactful, and they tend to be very well tolerated even by sensitive folks.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I love bitters myself. A little bit goes a long way sometimes for people too. It's fascinating. I know, and it's really interesting that so much of the digestive tract responds to it, not just the taste of it. It's like, I always think back to like essential oils, how like the skin has olfactory receptors, like the skin smells, it's like the gut tastes, you know. It's really, yeah, really fascinating stuff, for sure. So this constipation issue can be a really big deal in mold illness. And I think we discussed a little bit of, you know, the mechanisms to how, you know, how it can be detrimental. But could you elaborate a little bit on that end of things, you know, how the constipation is not good for mold illness in this regard?
Yeah, so there are multiple mechanisms physiologically that can explain why mycotoxicity causes or aggravates constipation. You know, hormonal dysfunction, especially the thyroid, can affect motility. Nervous system, especially the vagus nerve, tends to affect motility. And so if there's inflammation or dysregulation there, mycotoxicity tends to contribute to limbic overactivation, which is that part of the brain that regulates the fear response and feelings of safety. And so if we're in fight or flight all the time, you know, or fight, flight, or freeze, especially thinking about the freeze from like, okay, if the fight, flight, or freeze, we could kind of go on a tangent with that, but the freeze response is, oh, this isn't safe, I'm not going to move. You know, and we think about that in the gut, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to hold on to stuff. I'm not going to let things go, right? And so there's the nervous system, there's the endocrine system, you know, AKA the hormonal system, and then there's inflammation at the gut lining. And so especially if we're getting molds from foods, or from the respiratory tract, you know, the sinuses and the nasal passages are interconnected with the gut, just the further down you go. And so oftentimes, you know, these are things that are going to contribute to dysmotility and lack of removal of things from the body. And then when we think, why is this a problem? Well, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about earlier with the emunctories, and how the liver, gallbladder, and gastrointestinal tract, as a way of eliminating toxins from the body is absolutely central. I had a patient yesterday ask me a phenomenal question, which is, if I can't take a binder, can I still detox? What happens if I take all these cellular detox agents like glutathione and vitamin E and calcium D-glucrate and phospholipids, and if I'm not taking a binder? And I said, well, we are still detoxifying a little bit through the skin, especially if they're doing a sweating practice, and a little bit through the urinary system. But the GI tract and the liver gallbladder system is absolutely key. And so I think it's worth it to spend as much time as is needed to restore motility and regular bowel movements before binding, than kind of trying to skip that step and say, well, let's give you a bunch of detox agents that are going to pull stuff out of cell of storage, get them into circulation, and then have them have nowhere to go. Essentially, they just become recirculated as the bile gets reabsorbed. So,
sure.
That, and then of course, there's also a lot of microbiome dysregulation with folks. And so, if you have microbes that aren't so friendly, they're going to be secreting their own waste. And if you're constipated, that stuff kind of builds up too.
Sure. So, would you use probiotics in these cases too, or how would you help the biome?
That's a great question. Sometimes, but oftentimes, if there's dysmotility and things aren't moving, you end up with either a migration of bacteria from the large intestine where they're supposed to be upward into the small intestine, or if you have not enough stomach acid production, you can have bacteria that are supposed to be killed in the stomach actually migrate downward into the small intestine. In either case, it can cause what's called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO. Sometimes you'll hear people say SIBO as well. And so SIBO can aggravate constipation. It also means there's too many bacteria where they're not really supposed to be. We have like a fraction of the amount of bacteria in our small intestine than we do in our large intestine. And so giving a bunch of probiotics to somebody with dysmotility can often aggravate that. But there's an art to that, right? So sometimes we think about spore-based probiotics, which actually kind of kills some of the guys that aren't supposed to be there. And so there's a nuance there. Sometimes Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a beneficial yeast, a great probiotic to have on board when you're doing antimicrobials, that can flare people with mold sometimes, not always, but sometimes. And so it can also help detox mycotoxins. So there's definitely a lot of complexity that we kind of have to navigate. And just for our viewers, not to overwhelm you, this is why it can be very helpful to have a health practitioner as your partner on this journey.
Definitely. Because this can get really frustrating, can't it? Yeah, I mean, you can read everything online that I have to be doing this binder, I should be doing this probiotic, or I should be doing this glutathione or something like that. And then, every time we try to do this, it makes me feel worse, or it makes me, it makes me more constipated or something like this. We mentioned SIBO. That's always an interesting one. Small intestine bacterial overgrowth, or in some cases, small intestine fungal overgrowth, which is interesting. That also can make a challenge, can't it, in terms of binders and stuff like this. Fibers might be more reactive or something along these lines. How do you navigate some of those dynamics with SIBO?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we think about, and then we haven't talked about fiber yet, interestingly enough. So I'm glad that
let's talk about fiber then.
Let's talk about fiber. So most of us have probably heard eating a high fiber, high vegetable diet is a great thing from a bowel regularity standpoint, from a colon cancer prevention standpoint, from just an overall health standpoint. But this can cause a lot of folks to get into a real bind when they have chronic GI issues, where fibers can cause diarrhea or constipation even, where they can cause gas and bloating, abdominal cramping, burping, those kinds of things. And a lot of that comes down to what we would call fermentation, which is the microbes in our gut say, hey, free food, this is awesome. And they digest our fibers before the fiber from our food before we're able to. And then that creates a lot of gas and a lot of distension, a lot of times abdominal discomfort. And so giving a bunch of prebiotic fibers, giving a bunch of high fiber vegetables, especially more fermentable ones, to somebody with SIBO or SIFO, that's the yeast or fungal overgrowth, that can sometimes aggravate. And so you either have to find out what fibers that an individual can tolerate, or you kind of use something like the specific carbohydrate diet or the low FODMAPs diet as like a guide to, okay, these are foods that are less fermentable and less likely to aggravate, and these are, foods that I should be eating, because we do want some fiber, especially if there's constipation. We just need to find the right kind of fiber.
What would be some starting fibers you would think of for the more, you know, sensitive situations here?
Yeah, so that's a good one. Caught me off guard just a little bit. Pull that one up. I haven't gone low FODMAPs with folks in a little while, but that would be a really good starting point, is looking at, I mean, there are lists that are readily available, which is, you know, which are low FODMAP foods, but we could certainly have which ones are you thinking of typically initially?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I may not even start with, you know, fibers entirely in those cases. I would have to say on a personal level, but, you know, in some cases I will, you know, kind of work into, you know, some of them out there, but yeah, I will talk about that in a little bit though. Not a problem. We're gonna move to a different avenue here. How about non-fiber stuff though? Like how about like gentle non-constipating non-fiber binders? Is that a possibility?
Yeah. So the non-constipating non-fiber. Well, depends kind of who you ask, but I think about modified citrus pectin as not being a very potent. It's not really too fibrous. Some of the formulations of it do have like polyols, you know, sugar alcohols and things, especially the tablet versions of them. But I'll use a fair amount of modified citrus pectin. It's not a super strong binder, but it's a fine place to start. Chlorella, a lot of folks do okay with. It can be constipating as well if you take too much of it. And then there, you know, some of the humic fulvic, you know, mineral blends. There's a few brands that have developed more sensitive formulas that Dr. Kunkel and I have talked about. I don't know if we can talk brands on this or not, but there are some out there that are gentler. I always try to frame that as this is a starting place and we're working on your gut, because we really almost always need some kind of charcoal or zeolite or bentonite or, propyl mannan is getting a lot of attention nowadays. It's not a super strong binder, but it does bind every type of mycotoxin, according to the research. And so I find having a rotational schedule with binders is key when it comes to mycotoxin removal, but it's a journey. And so as Lasu said, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And so step one is let's keep things moving. And even if there's just a gentler binder that we can start with, that's better than no binder. And then we just kind of build on that over weeks to months, depending on the progression that we're seeing.
I know one concern I get with binders quite a bit from patients too is like the timing of the binder. Like what's the best time to take the binder, or when should I not be taking the binder, so to speak? Or am I going to bind good stuff just as well as bad stuff? You know, could you speak to that concern?
Yeah, so it depends a little bit on the binder. It also depends a little bit on the person's situation. And so what I'm about to say, I learned from you actually, Dr. Kunkel, which is, you know, taking a binder at night is a great if you have a gallbladder, right? If you don't have a gallbladder, this doesn't necessarily apply. But if you have a gallbladder, according to Chinese medicine, I'm sure you could elaborate this more than me, but according to Chinese medicine, the gallbladder is most active during that 24-hour cycle of 11 to 1, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, the gallbladder has, that's 11. Yes, that's
great. And so, and there appears to be, you know, kind of a gallbladder dumping of bile that happens in a more pronounced way during the night when we're sleeping. And so if folks aren't taking, if I have folks who need a lot of sleep support, medication or supplement wise, then I may have them take a binder in the evening, at least an hour to an hour and a half, sometimes even 2 hours, depending on what their motility looks like, before they take anything else. And so if a patient's not able to take a binder right before bed because they need to take other things, I'll have them take it, you know, between dinner and bedtime, essentially. If they don't have a gallbladder and we're not, you know, they're that way, or in cases like that, bile is just kind of always draining into the intestinal tract, that timing is less important. I know there are some protocols where binders are dosed in the morning, because that's a little bit easier logistically. First thing in the morning, you take it an hour and a half to 2 hours away from anything else. And that's a strategy that's fine as well. And so from a clinical standpoint, I haven't necessarily seen dramatic differences. It's more a matter of logistics and what's feasible for that person. We're also often trying to juggle many supplements. Sometimes that's an understatement in folks with chronic mycotoxic illness. And so we're weighing those factors as well.
Yes. No, very interesting. So So say you fix the constipation here. Now we're kind of getting things moving along as far as that goes. You know, what do you want to step up in the gut? Like, what's your ideal sort of end game for approaching the gut in these type of cases, aside from just what we've already discussed? Motility, yes, very good.
Yeah, so a lot of it depends on, so it's a thorough assessment, and a comprehensive individualized assessment is key. And so if somebody's complaining of gastrointestinal symptoms, that's going to really hone my attention in on saying, okay, we need to figure out what's causing this. Is there dysbiosis, aka imbalance of the microbiome? That can include opportunistic organisms that don't cause issues for everybody, but when the immune system is stressed, they cause issues. That could include frank pathogens, which are bad guys and are never good to have, you know, Salmonella, Campylobacter, you know, there's many that we could talk about. Parasites, for sure, are a consideration there as well. And so, you know, assessing the microbiome in folks with kind of gastrointestinal issues, we could do a whole talk on just parasites. So, you know, as I said that, I'm like, oh, that's a whole topic in the limits of testing for parasites. But basically evaluating whether or not there are pathogens or dysregulation in the microbiome, evaluating how much inflammation is in the GI tract. Are we dealing with inflammatory bowel disease, or are we dealing with more subclinical inflammation from food sensitivities, from the, like I said, the microbiome being dysregulated can cause an increase in inflammation at the GI lining, irritants, right? So if somebody doesn't have a gallbladder and they're draining bile all day, that can cause irritation. And when that causes symptoms, it's known as bile acid diarrhea. And so sometimes we see that. The stomach acid production, digestive enzyme production, these are all factors that play a role. And so I'll often do a stool test. I'll often do food sensitivity testing, or at the very least, a trial elimination diet, which is where you remove for a temporary period, usually 4 to 6 weeks, of common environmental, common food triggers for folks. And to be clear, these aren't necessarily allergies in the sense of when I eat this food, I need an EpiPen immediately, or something very bad is going to happen, but more low grade delayed type immune, what we call hypersensitivity reactions. And these can all stress the gut, and the microbiome can contribute to leaky gut, that kind of stuff. And so I'll often do a stool test, a food sensitivity test, and a SIBO breath test. You drink this drink and, you know, you collect breath samples at certain intervals, and it basically sees how much your gut ferments it and what types of gas you produce. And then that will kind of tell us what types of bacteria are potentially overgrown. So comprehensive assessment is the short answer. And then treating each individual, and we have a variety of tools to do that. And so if there is leaky gut or impaired intestinal barrier function, it's the same thing, it's just more technical. You know, we're gonna do things that are gonna help soothe the GI lining and repair those tight junctions. If it's really inflamed, we're gonna give anti-inflammatories that are primarily focused on the gut. If it's microbiome related, we're gonna give things that, you know, I call it weed, seed, and soil. It's like you give antimicrobial herbs often, sometimes even antibiotics, to get the bad guys out. That's the weeding. And then there's the seeding. I like spore-based probiotics for that because they tend to not aggravate. Sometimes sensitive folks, especially folks with mold toxicity, you just have to go really slowly with dosing that, you know, opening up the capsule, that kind of thing. And then the soil, you know, we could kind of talk about this a little bit, but there's some interesting work with a company in Portland working on fecal-derived postbiotics. Which are postbiotics are basically beneficial metabolic byproducts of the microbiome. Like when you have a healthy gut, a healthy microbiome, they're going to be co-digesting our food with us, but it doesn't cause issues. It actually is really health promoting. And so I won't necessarily go too into that, but there's some thinking about postbiotics is kind of the short answer of the soil.
Yeah, right on. No, I like that. That's awesome. So do you feel like getting the biome in balance is also going to help us detox then?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the microbiome can be our friend or it can be our foe. And so if folks are having microbiome dysregulation, as I touched on earlier, they're also generating a lot of waste. They're like, yeah, you could have good bacteria that generate beneficial things, which we call postbiotics. That's technically still waste, but it's waste that's good for us. It's like, just like trees, you know, they utilize carbon dioxide and then release oxygen. For them, oxygen is their waste, but it's good for us. And then we release our waste, which is carbon dioxide, which is good for them. And so all throughout nature, we see these symbiotic relationships where these organisms work together. And our microbiome is so central to our health. There's a great book on this topic called the Mind-Gut Connection by Emmer and Mayer. He's a functional gastroenterologist that goes into the science of how our microbiome, you know, throughout the body, 10 microbial cells, there's 10 microbial cells for every one eukaryotic human cell. And so, and then the metabolites circulating in our blood, there's 100 of those from microbes for every one human. So we're an ecosystem. We're not even an organism in the sense of being isolated from the natural world. And so the health of the ecosystem is the health of us. And so if the microbiome is not working for us, it is often a detriment to health. And there's a whole lot we could, you know, get into about how best to do that. But those are kind of the foundations to think about.
Right on. Yeah, the microcosm and the macrocosm also here. Speaking of the macro, we mentioned diet a little bit, you know, and kind of, you know, our broader environment around us and kind of maybe how that, you know, plays a role in these illnesses. I know that a lot of folks, you know, express, you know, concerns about certain things in the diet, maybe, you know, containing mold or worsening mold syndromes or something like this too. How do you, you know, without getting into, obviously it's completely individual, but, you know, as a superficial point of discussion, how would you approach an ideal, you know, diet for the gut, for detox, you know, for avoidance of, you know, mold related sensitivities?
Yeah, great. So I direct my patients to Jill Cresta's work. She's done some truly exceptional work in paving the road for treating mold toxicity and all the naturopathic pillars like diet and lifestyle that go into that. And she has some great information on mold-free diet.
I believe she'll be interviewed as well during the summit. So you'll get a chance to talk to, we'll get a chance to talk to Dr. Jill as well, Dr. DeCrista.
Great. Then I don't want to botch any of her work, but she has some great handouts on lower mold diets. And so things like nuts and mushrooms for some folks can be aggravating. With produce, it's tricky because there's so many good things in vegetables, like the sulforaphanes and the glucosinolates and, you know, sulfur containing compounds that are going to increase glutathione production in the liver and the fiber, you know, all that stuff's really good. But you know, you don't want anything that has visible mold on it, which kind of almost goes without saying, but, you know, sometimes the things that are sitting in those moisture dens in the produce department, you know, that can be a factor that we think about as well. And so diet, I mean, I just want to acknowledge, you know, diet when you're chronically ill is it can be very stressful. And we want to do the best that we can is kind of what I offer patients, which is let's work together and figure out what foods you tolerate from a digestion standpoint. And then let's work together to try to minimize exposure to foods that we know are high in mold. And then we focus on foods that may have some mold, but getting them out, minimizing exposure, airborne exposure, seems to be, you know, kind of that, at least for me, that's what I focus most of my attention on for folks.
Mm. Yeah, making sure their environment's safe. Mm-hmm. I'm going a little off script, understandably here, but this is another question I get a lot though too, is, you know, when is it that my mold is actually like infecting me, or not infecting me, but colonizing me, like in my gut? Like at what point do you think about maybe treating mold as a sort of infection or something like this? What is your sense of that?
Yeah, so the way I was trained and then kind of the way that I have kind of seen that play out is you don't want to start antifungals too early in somebody who already has a high mycotoxin burden, because if there is colonization of mold or yeast, even candida, can produce certain mycotoxins in the gut or in the sinuses, and you start, you know, nuking them, and they're going to be releasing their mycotoxins. And then if somebody already has a pretty full toxic bucket, that can overflow and they can feel a lot worse. And so I'm almost always, one, making sure they're having regular bowel movements, then starting them on binders, you know, thinking about antifungal herbs. Those tend to be more gentle. When we're doing binders and we've been doing them for a while and we know that we've gotten them out of their moldy environment, which sometimes is easier said than done, if they're not substantially improving or if they hit a plateau, that's when I'm really thinking about colonization. I'll often preemptively assess their gut and their sinuses. I'll do a sensitive nasal culture that assesses for multiple antibiotic resistant staph, as well as fungal colonization. We may not always see fungal colonization. The lab we work with, I love, because they'll actually keep the fungal culture for an additional 2 weeks if it doesn't grow in that first time. And so it does improve the sensitivity. Sometimes I do see it, but there are other times where it's like this, I'm really suspicious of colonization, but we're not seeing it on the culture. Do we still treat? And so I'll do a lot of nebulizing. There are certain nasal sprays that can be helpful. Nasal ozone can be helpful. As long as you don't inhale it in your lungs, I would recommend that you talk to a doctor if you're thinking about doing nasal ozone insufflation. And then, you know, gastrointestinal antifungal stuff is going to be your, you know, herbs, prescription nystatin. And then there's the systemic antifungals, like the azole antifungals or liposomal herbal formulations.
Yeah, right on. No, I like that. Yeah, there comes a time where that conversation may come up in this journey. It's true. But first things first, getting the gut and work in order. So that's what we're looking to do here. So yeah, very, very helpful here. So you and I are both naturopathic doctors too, you know, and, you know, some things, you know, I consider us both integrative too, you know, maybe we do a little bit of this and a little bit of that and all this kind of thing, but I really like our naturopathic roots and background too. And I'd love it if there's anything else you could add from a naturopathic perspective here on that we haven't discussed yet for treatment, for approach, for, you know, understanding these illnesses and how to get them moving in the right direction.
Yeah, so there may be other doctors or other speakers in this conference that touch on this, but just to kind of whet your appetites a little bit, the limbic activation and the PTSD and the anxiety component is what I see to be one of the primary obstacles to full recovery from mycotoxic illness. And this is one of those things that I didn't focus a lot of attention on initially. I was very focused on treating on everything we've talked about today. But what I've seen is that there tends to be significant anxiety, and this is very understandable. You know, if my home isn't safe, you know, if my brain is inflamed, if my gut isn't working, if I don't know what to eat, all of these things are going to contribute to hypervigilance in the nervous system. We also often see there was something I was going to say and I totally lost it, about the nervous system being hyperactivated. And the isolation of living with a chronic illness that is not often understood or accepted, especially in mainstream circles. A lot of folks that I talk to have been to so many doctors who have said, "I no way that it could be mold." You know, if you have, you know, chronic infections as well, like Lyme disease or co-infections, which we see a lot coexisting with mycotoxicity. We don't believe in that, or, oh, we don't have anything for that. Here's a referral to occupational therapy and psychiatry. And this is traumatic for a lot of folks, and understandably so. And so the conversation that I really like to have with folks is, this is not in your head. This is a real experience. This is physiologic. Your body is changing. But what part of your body is also your brain, which is a structure. And so as the brain changes in response to trauma, as the brain changes in response to mycotoxicity, as the brain changes in response to infection or inflammation, there's a process called microglial activation, which is where the immune cells in our brain become primed to over-respond to things. And so that's when, you know, we see neurological inflammation show up as, you know, brain fog or fatigue or, you know, anxiety and depression in those capacities. And so we got to suss those pieces out. But I do find that I can't ignore the fact that we often do have to treat the anxiety and the PTSD as its own thing, but that's deeply connected. And so at BioReset, where I work now, you know, we have a few tools that we use to do that. We do IV ketamine. We do Dr. Matthew Cook, who's an anesthesiologist who runs our practice, does something called the stellate ganglion block, which is a ultrasound guided nerve block of the sympathetic chain, which temporarily shuts down the fight or flight response and kind of, it's like a reboot for the nervous system. And that's been helpful for a lot of folks. And then everything naturopathic that we would think about, you know, brain retraining programs. There's the Gupta program and the DNRS program, Nervine botanicals that increase GABA activity in the brain and are calming. Taurine is phenomenal. It's calming to the brain. It also helps with detox. And so the brain and the body, and then the mind and the body, they're not separate. And so naturopathic, you know, the way I describe it is body, mind, spirit, environment. You know, it's all interrelated. And the degree that we to which we have tools to intervene on these different levels doesn't necessarily mean that these levels are separate from one another. It's just how do we approach them.
Yeah, that's what I really
love.
There's
nuance there for sure.
That's what I really enjoy about our medicine is how everything is interconnected, you know, how we interconnect everything, you know, like the mind and the body, the gut and the brain, you know, I mean,
right.
In this case, they are connected, aren't they? I mean, either the vagus nerve or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which they're connected, which is really fascinating. Do you find sometimes too, just curious, do you find sometimes if you treat the gut that the neuropsych symptoms as they're described, you know, also improve?
Often. And the mechanisms of that are, and I've been doing this for a little while, even in med school, working on this with myself and working on this with peers, you know, so there's been a number of years that I've been thinking about this interrelatedness. It still astounds me. I mean, it absolutely blows my mind that when you decrease inflammation at the gut barrier, you often can think clearer and you're less anxious and more less depressed and you're sleeping better. When you change the microbiome by getting rid of pathogens, you know, I've noticed some people tell me when I do antimicrobials in the morning or whatever time, and then I take binders at night, and then I have my bowel movement in the morning, I feel less anxious after I have my bowel movement in the morning because you've taken the binder, you've gotten all that stuff out. Yeah. And so, you know, changing the microbiome, and even just a few years ago, there was in a mainstream news source, I wouldn't necessarily call them case reports, but case vignettes, I guess, of patients who were being treated by psychiatrists and were not responsive to, with pretty severe psychiatric illness, not responsive to medications, and then they were given a probiotic, and then their depression lifted.
Wow.
So this doesn't apply to everybody, for sure. There's a lot of complexity there, but absolutely, the mind-gut, the gut-brain microbiome axis, as it's called, is deeply a central network to how we feel. Our microbes produce neurotransmitters and hormones. Neurotransmitters are brain signal molecules that they make things that are structurally analogous to our own. And so even things like food cravings, it's like, okay, who's talking? Is this me or is this my gut microbes? And having abundant amounts of lactobacillus and bifidobacteria in the gut is associated with increased GABA production. They make GABA in the gut, and then that signals through the vagus nerve, presumably, to decrease the activity of the amygdala and calm things down. And so the short answer is yes, but how that happens is just so cool to me.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I always love to hear those stories as far as this goes. And that's definitely an observation that I've seen in my own practice as well. So really fascinating. And we are unwinding this. You know, I think probably 10 years ago, we didn't even know that the, you know, blood brain barrier, you know, was as it is, you know, it was just sort of a working theory. And now we know that's very similar in some ways to the gut barrier. There's a lot of, we didn't even know that there was lymphatics in our brain until recently, which is really interesting too. So if you want to quickly, you can speak to lymphatics. It's kind of a fun concept too, but the gut's pretty extensive in lymphatics too, isn't it?
Yeah. Lymphatics are super cool and underemphasized in the mainstream. But lymphatics. So what happens is when our blood is being circulated throughout the body, It's delivering nutrition to tissues. And a lot of times that fluid is bathing those tissues and then it needs to be reabsorbed. Otherwise we would just be these big puffy, pools of fluid around the extracellular space. And so that needs to be reabsorbed and then it ultimately gets recirculated and back into the bloodstream. And those channels or vessels, pipe system basically that reabsorbs that fluid is called the lymphatic system. And we have these lymphatic channels and vessels and lymph nodes even where there are immune cells concentrated, throughout the body. And there's actually a lot of them in the brain and in the gut too. Basically anywhere that's getting a lot of circulation of blood needs to have concentrated lymph vessels to help reabsorb that fluid. There's been some great, and I'm not going to do justice. Dr. Tom Moorcroft did a phenomenal talk last spring at the AAMP Infectious Disease Conference on the lymphatic system in the brain and strategies for supporting that. I highly recommend checking that out if you're able to get the recordings for that. But essentially there are these aquaporins and these, channels in the brain that help regulate fluid drainage out of the brain and into the rest of the body. And there are a variety of ways in which those channels and those draining vessels can become impaired, and that can lead to toxic buildup in the brain. And that's part of what's associated with dementia and cognitive decline. And in the gut, it's very interesting. And I'd want to do some review on the specific mechanisms of lymphatic drainage in the gut, but there is a lot. I mean, there's the gut associated lymphoid tissue, right? GALT and MALT. That we learned about in medical school, in anatomy. But what are these things doing? I mean, they're regulating immune function and they're regulating toxin removal. And so the degree that we can support circulation and drainage of lymph, the degree that we have a healthy functioning system. And that's where herbal medicine is truly phenomenal. Conventional medicine, at least not until I graduated from school, maybe there's drugs not available now, but to my knowledge, there aren't any medications that are lymphagogues that support lymphatic flow and drainage. But there are a ton of herbs that do that. And so, we think about that. We think about dry skin brushing, sleep position can affect lymphatic drainage from the brain. There's Dr. Kunkel formulated, when I was working with him at Revolutions, a great tincture combination of herbs for brain lymph and just general lymphatic flow. And that's been helpful at improving sleep for some of my patients and just overall quality of life. So there's a lot of things we can do: sauna, sweating, movement, stretching, massage, lots of things that can support lymph flow.
Love it. Yeah, lymphatic massage is out there too. I love, the lymph is like another emunctory of consideration we often forget.
And that's true. It's
all interconnected, of it. So working in an area that's stuck or stagnant kind of opens up other areas too, which is really fascinating. So if it's like all in the neck, that's like one of the prime drainage points, you want to work there, first sometimes. Yeah. So really cool stuff. I won't get into lymph, although it was just, I took an opportunity. We're almost out of time though. I wanted to, ask you kind of some of the exciting things that might be going on over there at BioReset with yourself and Dr. Cook. I know you guys are always doing some interesting things, but anything new in the world of mold that we might be looking forward to?
Yeah, so I joined BioReset Medical in the San Jose area about 7 months ago, and it's been super exciting to kind of take things to the next level with IV therapy and with regenerative medicine. Particularly ozone therapy. And so we do everything that Dr. Kunkel and I discussed today around personalized functional integrative naturopathic medicine. But we're also doing a lot of things intravenously, IV nutritional therapy, IV glutathione for folks that tolerate it, IV NAD for folks that tolerate it, various types of IV ozone therapy. So if you may have heard of the 10 pass or the multi pass, we do that, but we also do something that's fairly unique, and that's called extracorporeal blood oxygenation and ozonation, or EBU. And we have two variants of that. We have ozone dialysis and we have ozone plasmapheresis. It's a similar setup for both of them. You have two IVs. You have one pulling blood out, running it through an elaborate filtration system and ozonating it, and then returning it to your other arm. And this is happening kind of continuously for about 45 minutes. The difference is ozone dialysis is a higher potency of ozone, and it's a little bit more antimicrobial. It's great for acute infection. At least that's what we're seeing clinically. And then, but it, and it has a little bit of detoxifying effect, not as much as plasmapheresis, as is in plasmapheresis, but some, so it's going to be removing some microbial debris and some of the proteins. It kind of creates this foam-like filtrate. Ozone plasmapheresis, though, is very interesting as it pertains to mycotoxicity. That actually removes about 20 to 30% of your blood plasma, which is the liquid portion of the blood, and returns your cells, essentially. Conventional plasmapheresis, which has been used in hospitals and other centers for autoimmune disease treatment, where it basically removes all of your plasma, which is the liquid portion of your blood. So it's siphoning off antibodies, autoantibodies that are causing the autoimmune flare, and then you often will give IVIG. This one is much gentler, and then there's a little bit of ozone is involved as well. And so we have a lot of folks with mycotoxicity saying, oh, I feel mentally clearer after doing that. I have more energy. It's kind of like if mycotoxins are circulating in the blood, you can get it out of you through your homunculus, but you can also kind of skim it off the top a little bit. And that's what ozone plasmapheresis is doing. So maybe it's a sneak into another homunculus, which is removing toxins directly from the blood.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think back to the old herbal like alternatives or blood cleansers, you know. There's a lot of different ways to cleanse the blood, so to speak. So that's an interesting thoughts. Yeah, all right. No, I like it. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to our viewers and talk about mold. And it's always good to talk to you. As we know, Dr. Plant's a good friend of mine as well, as a awesome colleague here in the field of complex chronic disease syndrome. So you can find him at BioReset in Campbell, California. And I myself am with Gordon Medical. So we're going to sign off here for today. Any last thoughts, though, to leave us with here?
It's a beautiful sunny day in California. I wish everybody a peaceful journey with your health. And we're here to support you if you need anything. We're both available for telemedicine in California.
Yes. All right. Well, you have a good afternoon, and to all the viewers as well, take it easy out there, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yep, have a good one. Thank you.